from the National Urban League. This is For the Movement, a podcast that discusses persistent policy, social, and civil rights issues affecting communities of color. I'm Don Cravens Jr., Senior Vice President of Policy for the National Urban League and Executive Director of its Washington Bureau. This week, we have a very special podcast episode. We recorded it from the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation Annual Legislative Conference. As you know, each September, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation hosts its annual legislative conference, attracting thousands of people to Washington, D.C. for programming, networking, professional development, town halls, and special events. If you've never been, please plan to do so next September. During the conference, the National Urban League held a number of events as well, including a panel discussion on mobilizing the Black community for sustainable social change. The moderator we tapped for the panel was Mr. Quentin James, co-founder of the Collective PAC, and our esteemed panelists included founder of Black Millennials for Flint, Latricia Adams, St. Louis County Prosecutor-elect, Wesley Bell, Charlottesville, Virginia Vice Mayor, Wes Bellamy, senior pastor of Community of Hope, AME, and convener of the Black Male Initiative, Reverend Tony Lee, and last but not least, my good friend, co-founder and partner at Think Rubrics, creator of hashtag WokeVote, DeWanna Thompson. This panel discussion was well over an hour, so we've broken up the discussion into two podcast episodes. Next, you'll hear part one of our panel discussion on mobilizing the Black community for sustainable social change. Enjoy.
Good afternoon. Everybody excited to kick off CBC this week. I am so excited to be here because this panel is really amazing. We're going to hear from some amazing folks today. But first, let's please give another round of applause for Mr. Mark Morial, who, in my opinion, has literally... help mold, I think, a lot of this new generation that we're seeing pop up. And he's been on that doing that for years. And so I'm very grateful for your leadership, mentorship, and friendship over the past few years. I also want to give a shout out before I bring up my panel. I want to recognize Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, who is joining us as well. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you. All right, so I'm going to ask my panelists to come up and join me. First, I'm going to bring up Ms. DeWanna Thompson of WokeVote and Think Rubrics. We'll do an introduction more formally. I'm going to ask my brother Wesley Bell to join us, who is the Democratic nominee for County Prosecutor of St. Louis County. All right. I'm going to ask Ms. Latricia Adams to join me from Black Millennials for Flint. Pastor Mike McBride with Faith in Action. Got a sub? Okay, come on up, brother. Reverend Tony Lee, my good friend, Reverend Tony Lee, please join me. Founder and senior pastor of Community of Hope AME Church here in Hillcrest, Maryland. And did Dr. Bellamy arrive yet? Dr. Wes Bellamy? All right, he'll be joining us shortly. He's in traffic, and so I want to thank him as well. So I didn't read bios because I wanted us to kind of hop right in, but I do want to start by please, and we'll start down with DeWanna and work our way back this way. Let us know who you are, what you're working on, and in that, can you let us know what was that kind of moment that really kind of sparked your engagement into what you're doing at the moment now?
Well, absolutely. Hello, everyone. My name is DeWanna Thompson, and I am a partner in Think Rubrics, which is a social impact firm. And I see my partners in the room, and we support each other because we love each other, and we hella Black, right? Yes. And so we're just excited to be here. We do work at the nexus of political work, electoral work, policy, and really programming on the national and the local level. And so we're excited because our programming is particularly focused on African-American communities and people closest to the pain. We are focusing our work on the South right now in terms of this electoral cycle. Yes, right? Because that's where we're going to win it. If you don't know, I'm here to tell you. I hail from Birmingham, Alabama, where we just showed you how the South is going to win this country in 2018. And so we're really excited to be here. And this is my great friend. We work on another PAC called the Black Church PAC, and he'll talk about that. But this opportunity to bring people of faith and center their experience into the electoral process and stop having people show up at our churches 2 days before the election with a hot dog. Amen? Amen.
anytime I can get Dawana to lead me in, then my life is going all right. And so I thank Jesus right now for Dawana giving me the heads up. No, but I am Pastor Tony, leader pastor, Community of Hope AME Church. I've come with a few hats on. One, I am the head of social justice for the Second Episcopal District of the AME Church. I bring you greetings from Bishop James Davis. If I don't do that, I get fired. Amen, someone. But I'm really here because I am filling in for Pastor Mike McBride and the amazing work we do with the Black Church Pack. We were helping in Alabama with Righteous Vote and all the work there, and so I am here as a result of that. I am also on the board of the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation, and also shout out, I'm on the board of visitors for Howard University School of Divinity, where we are grooming new pastors to be great leaders. And so with that, now the reason I am here is because we do not want politicians coming by churches just during the election cycles, but one of the things we do realize, and just being an AME, is that the AME Church was birthed out of social justice. The AME Church was birthed out of the fact that there was discrimination in church, and in that then, that because folks didn't want us to pray at the same time in the same way, we knew we had to shape our own peace to have political power, because a spiritual power is not just spiritual, it's not just effective, but can't transform community. And so therefore, we know that we need to organize churches all over this nation so that folks aren't just kind of coming for a shout, but are coming to watch their communities be transformed, that we can't just count numbers, but we have to make our numbers count.
Good afternoon. My name is Wesley Bell. So currently, I actually serve as, I'm from the city of Ferguson. You may have heard of it. In 2015, I was elected on the Ferguson City Council. And that was at the, 9 months after Michael Brown was killed. And so coming into Ferguson, it was a challenge. It was, I think everyone saw on the news what was going on. And I think that, as Mr. Morial pointed out, Ferguson was just one of several events that got us to where we are today, with an awareness of the need for criminal justice reform, to an awareness to address issues like mass incarceration. And so if you followed that closely, the prosecutor on that particular case was the prosecutor who I ran against this past August. He had been in office for 27 years, so close to 30 years. And everyone who I told that I wanted, that I was going to run for this office, told me there is no way you can win. And so when we talk about the power of voting and how important it is to get the vote out and get people out, I'm a living testament to that. And my thoughts were at the time, and I probably had conversations with Quentin about this. My thoughts at the time were, one, I know we can beat them. But two, how would that reflect on our region if he were allowed to just walk back into that office without a serious opponent? And so in addition to knowing that we could beat him, my thoughts were, I have absolutely no regrets, because there has got to be a change. And if we're not willing to step up to make that change, you know, how can we complain? And so So we ran, and on August 7th, we beat him. And I'm proud to say, and I had a great staff. My campaign manager is here. We beat him convincingly. So there was no need for a recount or anything like that.
Right.
And so I am the Democratic nominee for St. Louis County Prosecutor's Office, as Quentin said. However, we do have an election on November 6th, and so we need people to get out. Now, having said that, I'm not running against anybody. but you know, but voting is important. We have to make it a habit. It has to be a part of the culture, not just when there's a cause or a candidate that we're rooting for. We have to get out in every single election, and it has to be just what we do. And so I'm truly appreciative and humbled to be here today, and looking forward to being a part of a great panel.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. I apologize for my tardiness. We had some issues back in Charlottesville that we had to make sure we attained to. And my name is Dr. Wes Bellamy. I'm the immediate past vice mayor of Charlottesville, Virginia, still on the city council. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say, again, kudos and congratulations to this brother, Wesley Bell, who I often get your emails. And I got an email about another panel, and they're like, sending it to you. I'm like, you mean me or him or... We want both, but anyway, I'm happy to, much kudos and respect to you, as well as my brother Quentin from the Collective Pack, as well as Mr. Mario in the Urban League as a whole. I serve as the youngest elected official in the city of Charlottesville's history and only the 7th African-American in our city's history. I'm oftentimes the individual who's blamed for the white supremacists coming to Charlottesville, because how dare there be a young black man who says that we're going to push for equity in Thomas Jefferson's home. And my response is often, to hell with Thomas Jefferson. He's dead and gone, and it's our time now. But when we look at our community as a whole, and Charlottesville has become a hashtag of sorts, I want everyone to understand that just because we saw a white supremacist come to Charlottesville roughly a year ago doesn't mean that we're an anomaly. In fact, we're just a community in which they chose to come on this date, because white supremacy is prevalent in communities and cities throughout our country. It's not something that's regulated to the South. It's not something that you always were just going to see on television when someone slashes someone's face or throws a bottle here or there, or when 45 comes off this racist and, you know, bigoted attacks that he likes to often use. That's the overt kind, the covert and subtle racism that still exists within many of our communities. When you see that brother or that sister being passed up on a job that you know good and damn well they deserve, those subtle instances of racism, when you see the contracts from your municipality not going to that minority business but going to the good old boy company that they've been getting year after year, those subtle instances of racism, when you see that African-American teacher who's more than qualified but's being regulated to a teacher assistant position and won't be provided with the opportunity to actually become a teacher, or that teacher who's been teaching for 15 years who looks like you and I but can't get a principal position.
That's right.
When we look at the policies that currently exist on many of our municipalities throughout the country, they are rooted in systemic oppression and racism. And as long as we continue to be fooled by the shade room and baller alert and the other things that catch our attention here and there, or those very glamorous issues that make people from across the country and CNN and everyone else rain down on a city or two, and we think about it as a news cycle, while in your own neighborhoods you have things that have been going on for generations that we don't address, while those things continue to happen, we will be in trouble. But since we got a good reverend on this panel, I believe in a just God who makes sure that his people will always ride to the top. So I'm looking forward to not only hearing and learning from these panelists, but meeting some of you who will continue to do the work in your communities. Thank you.
That's a tough act to follow. Good afternoon. My name is Latricia Adams. I'm actually a proud native of Memphis, Tennessee, and the immediate past president of the Thursday Network with the Greater Washington Urban League, awesome, which is where Black Millennials for Flint actually was birthed. Black Millennials for Flint is actually the only African-American and Latino environmental justice and civil rights organization in U.S. history that solely focuses on the eradication of lead. The only one. We were shocked when we found out about that, but that's something to think about. Just to give you a little bit of background around why we were founded on the East Coast, but we definitely have Flint in our namesake. So back in December of 2015 is when the majority of the country began to hear about the Flint water crisis. However, the Flint water crisis actually struck 1 year previously. So it had been 1 year before we all heard about it that people had been exposed to corrosive and toxic water. So this movement actually was birthed from a place of frustration where we immediately responded, like many people did across the country, where we have to get water to Flint, which we definitely did. To date, we have donated over 40,000 gallons of water to the city of Flint. However, thank you, that still wasn't enough. So shortly after we did the initiatives with community outreach and actually touched base in Flint, Michigan, we had an opportunity to take youth with us to actually do door-to-door distribution in the city of Flint, as well as do canvassing and some political advocacy around making sure the residents didn't pay for poison water. So we were successful in that front. However, returning back right here in the District of Columbia, our students received papers stating that there were elevated lead levels right here in D.C. in their schools. So at that point, we were already mad about what was going on in Flint, but it wasn't just a Flint issue. So it took Flint to wake up a nation as it relates not just to lead issues, but just to environmental justice issues in general. Many times in the African-American community, because we are ridden with so many issues, it's kind of difficult to prioritize, right? But one of the things that kind of falls between the cracks and which impacts us the most is environmental injustices. So essentially what we did is we demanded justice immediately. This is where social media actually does work and work in our favor. We tweeted DC Council over and over and over where we essentially was like, we have to do something. So not just patch it up, not just turn the water off in our schools, but we need to do remediation, but not patch it up with just the remediation, but also back that up with policy and legislation. So back in June of 2016, backing it up a little bit, we were actually founded as a movement in February 2016, so we're rocking and rolling. In June of 2016, we did have an opportunity to testify before DC Council with policy recommendations where we built a coalition of other Black young millennial leaders in the district, essentially to one, yes, we want remediation, but two, we want it to be written into policy so that you have to put it in the budget so you can't gloss over it. So fast forward into 2017 in July, the DC Childhood Lead Prevention Amendment Act of 2017 was passed. So that was our hugest feat. It was definitely a challenge, but that's still not the end of the road. So yes, we got this piece of paper that tells us what the District of Columbia should do, but the next step is around accountability, but not just in DC, but we need to see these same types of laws and legislation across the state, across the country. There are less than 10 states in the United States of America that actually is mandatory for them to test for lead and water in our schools. Less than 10 out of 50, right? So a part of the work that we're doing is definitely still keeping Flint in the core of all of our work because that's what woke us up. But then the other part of that is to replicate this legislation. We don't have to keep building stuff over and over again if we have a model that can be replicated that can save our children. And the other part of that is around educational awareness, where lead doesn't just exist in water. So we do a lot of work around creating digestible information because lead is heavy, no pun intended. Oftentimes, it's a lot of technical information that's associated with lead exposure, but we work really diligently to ensure that we're able to captivate and engage people who are in our community so that they can know ways to prevent it, know what it looks like, but then also be able to advocate for themselves to make sure that they have accessibility to clean homes and also with clean water. So I want to just give a big up to the league for giving us this opportunity to take an initiative, right? Because we partnered with Buffalo Young Professionals where we just simply wanted to give water to Flint, but we noticed that this was something that was just bigger than this initiative and something that was much bigger than who we are as leaders in the district.
Thank you. Awesome. Okay, so I'm going to jump in here and kind of following up a little bit of your opening. Latricia asked a question of the entire panel. And that is, many of you have been a part of national moments. Some would call them national movements. The question I want to know from you all in a kind of personal sense is, and also some of those movements have been local, right? So like in your hometown where you're living. So what are some of the positives and negatives of
these incidents or these, you know, moments kind of blowing up and going viral or becoming national? What are some of the positives and negatives of that? Because I think a lot of times we hear criticism that this isn't sustainable, right, or it's not impactful. So can you unpack that for us a little bit and tell us, like, you know, how were those experiences positive and negative, and then how do we make these moments or movements more lasting and impactful?
Sisters first.
Great. I'll speak to that. So I think that, and this actually came up in a panel yesterday, but I think that oftentimes when things kind of go way to scale, it kind of loses some of its momentum. So oftentimes when you start from a grassroots perspective, capacity becomes a huge issue. So I think about my board of directors, where it's just five of us. We all have 9-to-5 jobs. We have a scientist on our board. We have me that works for a school district where it can become very taxing. And I think sometimes when you are in this grassroots space, you do need some additional support, but you also have to make sure that you invite the right people into your space of advocacy so that you can control the narrative of the work that you're doing and just control the work itself. So that very much so can become a challenge. But then on a more positive note is, I think that it is also really important that if you are on the forefront of your movement, that you're very clear in how you articulate coalition building, how you establish alliances where you can be very forthcoming and say, this is the way that I need you. I need support in this way, as opposed to many people coming into your space of advocacy and kind of trying to take over. So that's kind of been my experience.
Thank you.
I'll jump in really quickly just to say that one of the concerns that I had, particularly when we left out of Alabama and we were able to do something that nobody thought we were going to be able to do, they left and they left with no resources on the ground, no relationships on the ground. They got their win and didn't think about what was going to happen next. Our firm and the people that we work with and the partners that we work with are specifically looking at the way in which we create liberation tools for long-term strategy, right? And so if it does not have the next step associated with it, we don't even engage with it. So what we decided to do differently in the show that model, when you see things like Woke Vote, we didn't just wait till election day or say at election day, this is going to be it. If we win, we win. We lose, we lose. The first thing we didn't do was align everything with a candidate. And I know that for a lot of people, right? Right now, that may seem like a difference of opinion or something that we shouldn't do. But what happens whether they win or lose if that candidate is really not connected to the ground? People on the ground then feel like they've been used, and we have not created real power for those individuals to continue to build and do the things that they need to do in their community. So we have to center our moments and our projects and our strategies around the liberation and the strategy for the people that are going to continue them moving forward. So the one thing that I was concerned about is that, yeah, we were able to raise over $4 million in 8 weeks to come into Alabama. That had never happened before, particularly to spend in Black communities. But what I asked them to do when I started talking to them about the kind of work we needed to do to engage our Black people, the kind of strategy that we needed to do, they said, that's not going to work. We got to do this old school sort of traditional thing. And they wanted to spend $3.9 million of that on the old way that we had just lost in 2016. Right. And so what we had to do then was build something and fundraise for that. And in that money, we said, if you're not going to give us money that we can spend after December, then we're not going to do this. And so our program already had 6 months later built into it to come back to the communities, organize them, train them, create programs for them. And they're still on the ground right now, about to elect the first Black sheriff in Jefferson County, about to elect 19 different Black women leaders across the state, because they're still working and they know that the power lies with them. And so we have to push back on these donors and these funders from telling us that the work that we do has to only center around their priority. right? If their priorities don't center around our needs as a community, we got to pull that back. The thing I always tell people is there is a difference between doing good and doing well. And that difference is the difference between being rich and being wealthy, right? When you are rich, you got a couple of dollars, but if it's gone, it's gone. When you're wealthy, it can have lasting impact. So our strategies, they can't be good. They have to do well. We have to have wealthy strategies, and we have to have people who are willing to put the kind of wealth, the money and the wealth behind our strategies so they can have lasting impact.
If I can add just to hers, because we work similarly and together on the Righteous Vote side and dealing with the church, it was also understanding that in dealing with the church, you're dealing with what is a connected historical organization, but a very disconnected bunch of organizations. And it was important. What usually happens when you do civic engagement work in churches is you have organizations that have funding who come to the church and get bodies from the church. And so the churches provide bodies, and so the civic organizations that had the funding then provide kind of the framework. What we realized, though, is that we needed to build capacity in churches so that we could teach churches the science of engagement, so that it just wasn't about bodies, but what does it mean now for a church to be able to do phone banking and text banking? What does it mean for a church to do the door knocking? What does it mean for a church in this community to be able to identify a precinct and adopt a precinct and say that we are going to have this kind of impact and have the voter rolls and be able to know what to do with that? You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Okay. Therefore, church, because what happened when the gentleman just got in the White House was that a lot of folks decided not to fund black from colored folks. Right? That all that money dried up from organizations that usually had the money that then activated churches. Mm-hmm. So then the churches were sitting there waiting for these organizations that usually had the funding, and those organizations were running around because they didn't have the funding. Exactly. And so then the churches were sitting there, and the churches then were impotent and unable to actually do anything because they so much depended on those other organizations. But now we realize the churches have enough within themselves to be able to do it. Mm-hmm. They just needed to know how to do it, have the capacity to do it, to then be able to do it, and not have to wait for anybody else. So that's what we've been able to do in our doing, and it's kind of looking forward to be able to empower churches to have the capacity to actually be able to do the daggone thing.
Good stuff.
And I'm going to go back to the question, because you talked about that moment. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, living in Ferguson at the time, I teach at a college in Ferguson. And so a lot of what you saw on television was what I see from my front window. Literally, I live on South Florissant, which is across the street or a little bit diagonal from the police department. Matter of fact, the night of the, in November, the night that the grand jury hearing, the grand jury was announced that he was not going to prosecute, and that started more unrest. I was watching that from television, you know, from home, but I'm watching it from television. And y'all remember when the police car was on fire? That was right in front of my loft. And so from a distance, I'm looking like, oh, they done set my house on fire. And then when they zoomed in, it was the car. So I was a little bit relieved. Right. I was a little bit relieved there. But what it showed me was that, you know, and I'm gonna put a little historical perspective on this. So Missouri was a slave state, but Missouri was one of the few slave states that stayed in the Union during the Civil War. And so Missouri, St. Louis in particular, went from Civil War straight to Jim Crow. There was no Reconstruction because Missouri didn't go into the, didn't join the Union. And so St. Louis still is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And because you didn't see Reconstruction and you didn't see a strong civil rights movement in St. Louis, when unrest started in Ferguson, I liken it to it was a young movement. It was a movement. It was a movement that was still had some growing up to do, if you will, right? And so at the time, and what we see with a lot of not only Democrats, progressives, but African Americans, we get caught up in our issues sometimes. And we don't see the forest for the trees. And in this last election where the guy who won, I don't even like saying president and that name in the same sentence.
You shouldn't.
You're right. And so what happened in that election is that there were a lot of people who said, you know what, I'm not in love with Hillary. I don't like Hillary. And so maybe I just won't vote. And so to add to the points that were made, we have to start thinking strategically. We have to. And what that means is in a primary election, blood can let. If you got a disagreement with a fellow progressive or Democrat, that's the time to go after him. Blood can let. But when it comes to the general election, we have got to get out and we have got to support that candidate. And I think anyone, and I mean, I was a Hillary and Bernie person. I felt the burn and I thought Hillary is one of the most qualified people to ever run for office. But when she won, it was time to rally behind her and get her elected. And I think that anybody in retrospect would say, who would you rather have in office right now? We're working on our second Supreme Court justice. And do you know the significance of a Supreme Court justice? Right. A lot of the things that we want, voting rights that we talk about, women's reproductive rights, those are in jeopardy now because of some decisions that we weren't focused. And so what's in the past is in the past, but we have got to be strategic. And one thing that I always say is that, you know, the best activists don't always make the best politicians, and the best politicians don't always make the best activists. But when they work together, mountains are moved.
Well said.
And so we have to start making sure that we are thinking strategically. We're looking at the big picture. Sometimes we got to take that L to get to where we want to go because, and I'm using the same example, whatever you thought of Hillary, we would have been in a much better position had President Clinton, the second President Clinton, would have won that election. And so that's a lesson that we have to take going forward.
May I have just 90 seconds?
No, yeah, please. This is for everybody.
So when you ask the question, what have we learned? Some of us have been in, you know, movements, both national and being seen from a variety of different ways. I think not only locally from what transpired in Charlottesville, obviously the country was able to see that white supremacy was alive and well, but I think we as a local community, we were able to finally be able to give black women their just due for all the work that they've been doing in the city of Charlottesville. Mm-hmm. I think not only have we seen that locally, bless you, I hope nationally now more than ever we can give black women their just due, which I think to a certain extent some people have been a little disingenuous with it. We've been using our sisters as the way for us to be able to get what we want, but we don't truly support our sisters in the way in which we truly need to with our actions and our resources. It's one thing to give your words, but your actions and your resources must also be aligned. So in Charlottesville, one of the better things has transpired. For the first time ever, we had a sister named Nakia Walker who ran as an independent, and she became our mayor, the first black female mayor in our city's history. And for the first time ever, we have two African Americans on our city council. That deserves some claps. Yeah. So in Charlottesville, we appoint our own mayor and vice mayor. The council does. It's only five of us. So she actually nominated me to be mayor, and then I declined her nomination and nominated her to be mayor, and then told my colleagues they better get on board with it. And there was a room full of black folks, so they weren't going to say no. That's on the record. I don't mind if y'all show that. So that's one thing, right? The elevation of black women, not only Mayor Walker, but young sisters like Zayana Bryant, who actually wrote the initial petition for us to have the Robert E. Lee statue removed, and then she got it to me, and then we went forward. But Miss Holly Edwards and all of these local black women who have been carrying the load in our community for a very long time are finally getting their just due. So I think that's just a beautiful thing. Secondly, white people in our community have also realized that Charlottesville isn't this quiet, quaint town in which we're only known for Thomas Jefferson and the University of Virginia. There's, again, a lot of deep-rooted racism in our community. So maybe Wes isn't so crazy when he says that we need to move these statues or that we need to move forward with equitable practices and policies. And then thirdly, we were able to, when the whole statue situation was initially happening and I brought it before council and we voted, one of the things that we were able to slide through there was a $4.5 million equity package in which we were able to provide specific resources and allocate them to our communities. So that's 950
$150,000 for an African-American Heritage Center, $2.5 million for public housing redevelopment, a job position specifically for black male achievement, and a litany of other things.
It's huge.
Yeah, thank you. So a litany of other things, what some people call reparations, I just think it's just an equity package. But we were able to get these resources specifically for our folks to impact our communities. So that's a beautiful thing. We can use all of the energy that's surrounding something that's so volatile to bring out something that's powerful and it's going to have a long-lasting impact. Now, on the negative side, because unfortunately I heard a lot of us talking about, you know, some of the highlights and some of the things that we know about in regards to 45 and so forth. But I think it's important for everyone here to also know that when we stick our necks out for these movements, there are indeed consequences that come along with them. So there literally isn't a day that doesn't go by that I don't get a death threat. We've had bomb threats to my daughter's school. We've had things sent to my wife's job, stuff sent to our home. There's all kind of unintended consequences that come when we decide to speak up. But with those death threats and people attacking our livelihood and so forth, we've seen our community stand and rally behind not only myself, but others who've been willing to put their neck out for the movement. So I'm hoping that nationally that we can do the same. When you see that individual who you think just wants to be on TV, do you think about what sacrifice they're making just to speak up for you and I? We're so quick sometimes to try and judge people, or we want to say that they may be disingenuous for this reason or that reason, but are we truly thinking about the other side that comes along with that? When I think about the work that Quentin is doing with the Collective Pack and trying to literally bring about resources to encourage black candidates
to
get elected.
We're trying.
Right. That's a plug for you. You owe me money for that. Just kidding. But when I think about even the work that Brother Quentin was doing with soon-to-be Governor Gilliam in Florida and all of the articles that came out just because the collective, this black organization, decided to put money into his campaign. Right. So when we see those things, do we just shrug them off? When we hear about people saying that they have to deal with these very difficult issues personally, do we just shrug them off and say this is what they signed up for? Or do we support them with our time, our talent, or our treasure? And that is what I'm hoping we can get to. Mm.
As always, you can follow us on Twitter at NUL Policy for updates. Be sure to listen and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Play. Kudos to our communications and policy team here at the Washington Bureau and our editing team at Podfly. And thank you for listening to the National Urban League's For the Movement.